Hello, and welcome to Gonservation Conversations, the show that brings you the finest in environmental chats. Today, our guest is Jennifer Lonsdale, campaigner, co-founder, and trustee of the Environmental Investigation Agency UK, or the EIA for short. When Jennifer is not out working on environmental issues, she can be found watching her football team Norwich City or soaking up the sun and studying the whys and wherefores of cricket. No better way to spend a summer's day than that. Nice to have you with us, Jenny.
It's lovely to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Our absolute pleasure. Now, look, just to get us started, you live in one of my favourite parts of the UK. You live in Norfolk, don't you?
I do, and it's a wonderful place to live.
It's the most extraordinary place. I mean, is it a place where you find it invigorates you and recharges the batteries after all your work?
Yes, you can never not be inspired when you go out into the countryside or up to the coast. And we're so lucky because we have so many sort of variations of ecosystems. We don't have great big tall hills or anything, but that's good for bikes. And it's just the most inspiring and peaceful place to be in.
Have you got any favourite spots in Norfolk that you go to regularly, or just living there? Is that enough?
Well, really, living here is enough, but I do absolutely love going up to the coast. You have the variation of the beaches, absolutely some of the best beaches in the world, as well as gorgeous marshes and all sorts of migrating birds. And we have the seals. It's just so wonderful to go out and watch the seals when they've all had their little tiny pups, which soon get big and fat.
Yeah, there is something so magical about that part of the coast. And also, any time of year you go there is quite magical. Winter provides its own entertainment. Spring does, summer, autumn. Do you have a favourite season up there?
Well, I don't really. I came to the conclusion a while ago that life's too short to worry about which season you're in and that you should enjoy them all. And as each one arrives, I suddenly think, oh, maybe this is my favourite, but actually they're all my favourite.
I know what you mean. There's something that appears and suddenly you go, this is it. This is the magic moment. Today I was out in the garden because we've got a bit of sunshine and I saw my first brimstone of spring and I thought, oh, that's magical. And then literally 2 minutes later, I heard the first Chiff Chaff song. So all these things are marking points of changing time. And I think they're important reminders that we have a continually changing year.
That's what's so wonderful. And I've been out in the garden today, and gardening is one of my favourite things to do. And just seeing everything sprouting and seeing, as you said, butterflies and bumblebees, my tadpoles have hatched. And it's just lovely because you always feel it's the beginning of something new when it gets to this early part of spring.
I wanted to take you back because, of course, you grew up with sunshine, didn't you? And your life, and I presume your love of wildlife, comes from growing up in Uganda. Would that be right?
I think so. I was very lucky because it was a wonderful place to live. And I was born there. And there was just wildlife around us all the time. We were taken to national parks to see all the magnificent African animals and their ecosystems. And it was just part of life. And I think I was very, very lucky from that point of view. And it made me fall in love with animals and the natural environment.
And was there any creatures in particular that you fell in love with? Were you captivated by anything in particular?
I don't think you could never get over the wonder of seeing a herd of elephants. And I particularly remember one day we were driving along. We had to stop suddenly because there was a group of elephants crossing the road in front of us. And you have to wait for them. They're not going to wait for you. But those kind of magical things. And I can remember going out in a boat on what was the River Nile and hippos around. And then there was this little island and it was just literally piled up with crocodiles. And those are the kind of things. It's hard to say which is your favourite, because they're all special and they're all exciting.
Well, that's it, isn't it? Especially when you're immersed in wildlife in a place like you are in. It must be very difficult. And do you think also sometimes if you're surrounded by it, you kind of can take it for granted because it just seems like that is an everyday occurrence?
Yes, and I think it was a surprise when I came back to live in England because This was in the early 60s, and most people had never been to somewhere like Africa. And they couldn't believe that I didn't sort of have lions coming to the house all the time and things like that. And they sort of had this image that I might have been frightened being out there because it was just something that was a mystery to them. They might have seen them in a zoo, but seeing these animals in the wild, they just couldn't believe it. And so it was very special, and it was a great privilege for me to have that kind of upbringing.
And were you at all aware of conservation issues as a child growing up? Did you know about elephants being shot or hunted for ivory? Or was it more of an idyllic childhood where this kind of information followed later?
It was more idyllic than that. I mean, my parents knew people who were game hunters, and some of them used to come and visit when they were passing. And I didn't really think of it until I got a little bit older and when I was in my teens and I started learning about the destruction of species. And that's what really started to make me feel that something need to be done about these things. And I can remember, I think it must have been when Britain stopped commercial whaling. And I can remember listening on the radio about the decimation of whales. And I thought, well, somebody ought to tell them that they can't do this anymore because it's wrong. And I think that really sparked an urge in me to do something myself.
And so what was it that you chose to do? What kind of date are we talking about? When did Britain stop?
This was in the mid-60s, and so I think it was 1966. But then I was sort of more involved with growing up. I was lucky because I lived in the Kent countryside and we were always outside going on bike rides and going into woods and things like this. And I was then lucky enough to go and be a nanny in Bermuda, and that just really, it was so awe-inspiring, and I just loved the nature there and things like that. But it wasn't until I moved to San Francisco, and this was in the late 70s, when I learned about Greenpeace and what they were doing to stop the Russian and the Icelandic whalers from hunting by challenging them out in the oceans and getting between the harpoons and the whales. And this really got me excited, and I started volunteering with Greenpeace, and that's when I first really got involved in conservation and making my voice heard and really feeling that I could do something.
So once you open that door, it's very hard to shut it. And especially during the times of the 60s and 70s, which I would say was probably the great period of awareness for an awful lot of people, for normal people, not necessarily people who are connected with science or have been working on environmental issues. This was the first moment that we kind of crossed over into everyone knowing names like Greenpeace and then names like Rainbow Warrior. When you signed up for Greenpeace, was it just a gut feeling that you had? What made you want to go and work with them?
Well, when I first started volunteering from them and learning about the work they were doing and learning more about the issues, I just thought, well, this is fantastic because there hasn't been anything like this organisation before. And in those days, they weren't looked on hugely kindly because they were breaking the mould and they were going out and confronting Russian whaling boats. They were also going up to the ice and confronting the sealers and trying to stop the seal hunters from killing the baby seals. And I think that people started, governments in particular, started being somewhat alarmed that these people really, well, who were they? They weren't terrorists because we were non-violent. But who were we? I mean, we were just getting in there and interfering. And I think it started to get people really concerned. And then, but of course, then it was great for media because the TV companies suddenly discovered that actually this made great news. And so they started using the film that Greenpeace was taking, and it all developed into being a movement where people stood up and made their voices heard. And it's grown since then. So people like me had to, and my colleagues from in the early days of Greenpeace, have had to really develop the sort of the campaigning mold, the campaigning ethos of how it is today. And it's changed so much since we began. My father was really horrified when he heard what I was doing and who I was volunteering for, and then consequently working for, because it just didn't sort of fit into his way of thinking that people would speak out in this way.
I remember growing up and hearing the name Greenpeace and then, as I say, Rainbow Warrior and things, And it became this almost cult-like fascination for a lot of us growing up, because you'd hear about this and yet you could only find out a little thing, something might appear on the news, which was amazing. And you go, oh, what is going on here? And they'd be called dirty hippies, or using the word like activist as though it was some kind of dreadful insult. So was there a feeling of pride in a way that you were generating this kind of dislike, hatred from the normal world?
It was not the hatred that made me feel good. What made me feel good was that actually, despite going against the norms, we were making a difference. And it was always wonderful when, if you answered the phone and it was somebody who had been learning about whatever we'd been, whichever campaign it was, and just saying, I literally just had to pick up the phone and ring you and say thank you, because I can't go out there and do what you're doing, but I'm so pleased that you are. And that was just so inspiring that people were beginning to believe in what Greenpeace and other organisations were doing.
Yeah, and I think I wasn't kind of meaning the hatred was inspiring, but the fact that you would provoke a response, because often the way the authorities can shut people down is to ignore. And ignore usually means something's not going quite right on your side. So to provoke reaction, it must be a tonic for everyone. And what was it like when you would get together, say, in the office or wherever, the next day after there'd been another report on the news or something?
It was always exciting. And suddenly we realised that we were actually being listened to, and governments and decision makers, whoever they were having to listen to the messages. And if you think at the time that I was in Greenpeace in San Francisco, in the UK, they'd been out confronting the whalers in Iceland, but they'd also been confronting the dumping of nuclear waste off the coast of Britain. And the British government did not like that at all, but they had to do something about it. And that's, you get excited when you get big media hits, because you can see that the media is picking you up, but also you know that the politicians and other decision makers are having to listen to and having to react. So that gets very exciting, and you suddenly realise that all the difficulties and all the, you know, the effort you had to put into things is being listened to. When I was volunteering for Greenpeace, I used to sell T-shirts on Fisherman's Wharf at weekends. And that was actually really exciting, because sometimes people would be so excited because they were meeting somebody who was working with Greenpeace and they just wanted to show their support and talk to us about what we're doing. And others had never heard of us. And then they said, well, who are you? And when you talked about the work that we were doing and the campaigns and the risks that people were taking, they just got overwhelmed by it. And it was really tremendous to be able to give that message out to the public. And I think it made their day, actually, quite often. And also we sold T-shirts and that made a little bit of money for us.
And I guess in a way you were like the internet. You were the one who was giving out the information.
Yes, we had faxes and we had telephones, but we didn't have anything more advanced than that. Well, you had the post, but you didn't have anything more advanced than that. And how times have changed. And so when you put out press releases, they would go out by fax. You would also call up media people, and just so different from the way it is today.
Absolutely. And I also think there's something about that period of life. I mean, being in San Francisco in mid-70s must have been a fascinating place, because the world was only just sort of getting over the whole hippie revolution and the alternative culture and Haight-Ashbury and all of that sort of world. Do you think that things like Greenpeace came out of that whole period, but showed that actually with strength of thought, you could make things happen? Whereas the hippie culture did provide inspiration, but maybe not enough demonstrative action at times.
Yes, I think you're right. And they were the sort of tail end of the hippie movement, and particularly in the Haight-Ashbury area. And some of the people who were volunteering or working with Greenpeace were very, very in the hippie mode. And they had come from that period. And also one or two of them had been out in Vietnam, because they were conscripted into the US Army. And so there was a lot that had been going on in the previous decade before I came to Greenpeace and before really Greenpeace really started developing. But it was, and San Francisco is just the most lovely city. I was tremendously privileged to live there, and it was always fun. It was always interesting. And driving over the Golden Gate Bridge has always been one of my absolute favourite things. And yes, there was a culture of anything can go. I mean, it was the centre of the development of gay rights and accepting of people. They might be, you might consider them to be different, but everybody in San Francisco can be different, and you didn't have to be one way or the other to be different. But it was very much accepted, the whole gay movement, it was bringing equality into the way people were.
Yeah, and I always think of that period as suddenly people becoming hippies with teeth, that actually there were things really to get behind, to stand up for, to fight for, almost like the joint had worn off and it was time to get into action. I would have loved to have been there. I mean, personally, San Francisco, everyone goes on about LA. For me, whenever I've been over there working with bands and things, I can't wait to get to San Francisco. There's something there is still something magical about it.
Oh, there is. And it's just, and I haven't been for a long while, but it's always, when you go back there, it's always just as exciting as the first time you ever went there. And it just is a remarkable city because it brings about change on a social level. And it was perfect for Greenpeace being set up in San Francisco, because it had already previously been established in Vancouver, and there were European entities being founded, and Alan Thornton, who I formed EIA with, had set up Greenpeace in the UK. So there was a sort of global movement beginning to develop, but San Francisco was a perfect place for it too.
And how many boats did Greenpeace have at the time?
Two at that point. They had the Rainbow Warrior in the North Atlantic and the James Bay in the North Pacific. And there was one more that they got later on, and I've actually forgotten its name. But those were the two key ones that were doing the interferences and bringing the attention to Greenpeace of something that was really new and exciting.
So getting involved with Greenpeace, was the ambition to try and get on one of the boats, or was that unlikely in most circumstances?
For me, I was fine just doing sort of land-based things. I was working at the time. I was actually a cook in San Francisco when I first started volunteering, and then I stopped that job and I worked with Greenpeace for a while there. And I was very happy doing all the kind of support stuff, and I found that quite interesting and as well. And there were people who had more knowledge and more experience than I did who were going out on the boats and doing a lot more of the frontline stuff. And I was learning all the time, obviously, as well.
And were you aware of all the sort of literature that had been going on through the 60s and books like Silent Spring by Rachel Carson? Were they touchstones at the time, or were they things that you knew about or discovered later on?
Well, I was discovering that sort of stuff as I was, you know, I was learning more the more time I spent at Greenpeace, and they were very much part of the culture of people, again, standing up for what was right and bringing about change. And so, yes, I was learning more and more about that all the time.
And I guess literature in San Francisco, there were enough outlets that would be providing the information, the books that you could go and read. I mean, still, compared to how many books are out there at the moment these days and how many things get released, it must have still been quite difficult to get hold of things. But you were in a place where alternative culture was a way of life.
Yes, and there were lots of artists and poets and writers who were also, you know, taking a different route from the norm and producing wonderful work and inspiring work.
I was just going to say, it must have been a true inspiration to be around at that time. I'm very envious. I remember the first time I went to San Francisco was in the 90s, actually, and there were still remnants of the 60s there in the streets and people as well, who obviously hadn't quite got over the 60s. But for me, it's an important place. So I think it must have been a wonderful place to be and to start learning about this whole world. So what actually made you then decide to move on from Greenpeace? Had it you run your course work-wise over in America and wanted to come home? And what was the next step for you?
Well, I was thinking I was going to stay there, but then for family reasons, I decided to come back to England for at least a short while and then decided I thought I'd stay. And I moved to London and was absolutely loving London life. I had my brother right round the corner from me, and I developed a really strong social scene, and life was fun in London. And at the same time, I'd already made friends with Alan Thornton, and so I used to see him from time to time. And again, I was working as a freelance caterer in London, so I was pretty much flexible on what I could do. And I was just enjoying life in London, which I think is another fabulous city, and I loved every minute of it, really.
Yeah, well, and also it was not a bad period of time to be in London either, because I think that through that sort of period, the late 70s, early 80s, there was a real movement and an alternative culture that was permeating. I mean, they were the years that I was growing up, and everything was all about protest for the right reasons, I think, in a lot of ways, you know, what with CND, Rock Against Racism, and all those sort of other things that were going on at the time. It was a great time to be alive and saying, we don't agree.
I think that you're right about that, and things were changing. But we were learning more as well at that time, because we founded EIEA in 1984, and that was only 2 years after the ban on commercial whaling had been passed. And at that time, we didn't really know that much about climate change or global warming. We didn't even know anything about the ozone layer, but we did know about things like pollution and the need to protect the environment and the decimation of certain species that were, you know, we'd sort of had this attitude that there would always be plenty of these particular animals, but suddenly we were starting to see extinctions. So it was quite an interesting time, and a greater awareness of the fact that action had to be taken. WWF had been founded in the late 50s. There were other organisations which were beginning to be developed, and it seemed right for us to just continue doing what we wanted to do. When I came back to live in the UK, I didn't start volunteering for Greenpeace or anything. I was just enjoying my life there. But then Alan Thornton got in touch, and we caught up with each other and one thing another. And he said to me, would you like to do some work with me? Because I'm taking a break from Greenpeace, and I think it would be nice to be able to choose to look at some issues that I wasn't able to do when I was in Greenpeace, because it wasn't in our sort of strategic plans. And so I thought, well, yeah, why not?
Yeah, absolutely. And is this how you ended up buying a boat?
Well, yes. The thing about Alan, he has very high ambitions, and he's always had, and it's something I've learnt a lot from him, is he never has an attitude that you can't do something. And I went round to have a cup of tea one day, and he said, I've had this really good idea. Why don't we buy a boat and go to northern Norway and document Norwegian whaling? Because it's one of the things I didn't do in Greenpeace, because we were more focusing on Spanish and Icelandic whaling. And I said, well, sounds like a good idea. Didn't really think too much of it. But then a few days later, he said, I found some money and I found a boat. And it was an old North Sea trawler that we brought down from Aberdeen to London, put it in the then empty West India dock, and got a whole load of people who'd worked on the Rainbow Warrior and were used to painting boats and getting things together, and did up the boat. And he then said, I think you better be the cook. And by the way, you have to organise all the provisions for the trip, because you seem to me like the person who would do it best. So I thought, oh, OK, fine. It was a bit of a shock. I hadn't really thought of that. I thought I was going to be more land-based stuff, but I decided to go. And first of all, I had to think about what crew would eat over 6 weeks and when we might or might not be able to get extra provisions, and think about how I was going to manage all the catering. But I actually enjoyed it. It was fun. It was exciting. And I wasn't the only one, because sometimes it can get a bit boring when you're just at sea and people are like, oh, I want to do the dinner tonight. And I'm going, okay, fine with me. I'm happy to delegate. And it was great. We had some very good food. In fact, somebody said to me that the chap had been on the Rainbow Warrior. He said, I never put weight on when I was on the Rainbow Warrior. In fact, I used to lose weight, but I think I got fat on this trip. I said, well, that's your fault. You ate too much. I did spoil them.
Well, it's probably intense work, isn't it? Most of the time on a ship like that. And what did you call the ship and why?
It was called the Balenoptera. And the Balenoptera is the family name for all the baleen whales, things like blue whales, fin whales, thigh whales, and it goes right down to the minke whale, which is the smallest of the baleen whales. And those were the whales that Norway was hunting at the time. And so we thought it was rather appropriate to call the boat the Balenoptera. An artist friend of ours painted a minke whale on each side of the bow, which looked absolutely magnificent. And off we went.
So was it a case, because it's not exactly an undercover operation if you've got a boat decorated with whales, I guess, or was there still, because nobody was doing this sort of thing in that part of the world, nobody was expecting someone to come and document the whaling issues? And why were you picking on Norway as your first subject? Was this because of what you believed was happening up there, or what you knew was happening up there?
The first thing is that Greenpeace had documented Icelandic whaling in the North Atlantic, but they hadn't been to Norway. And the ban on the non-exploding harpoon was implemented by the International Whaling Commission in 1981. And in 1983, Norway was still continuing to use that harpoon. And whilst harpooning a whale is very cruel anyway, using a non-exploding harpoon was even more cruel, because you had a much smaller chance of instantly killing the whale. And nobody had documented Norwegian whaling at that time. There was no film of it. And so we thought, well, this is the perfect opportunity to go up there and do something that nobody else has done. And then we can take the evidence back to the International Whaling Commission and publish it around the world, so that pressure can be put on Norway to do something about changing the type of killing method they were using and reducing the suffering imposed on the whales. The other thing is, they hadn't decided whether they were going to implement the ban on commercial whaling, because although the ban was actually passed in 1982, its implementation was 1986. And they had quite a high quota of minke whales in that interim period, and particularly for 1983, it was about 1,600 whales in a year. In fact, after we had come back with our documentation, their quota was cut the next year by about two-thirds. So it did have quite an impact. And also, they decided that they would change the type of harpoon they were using. So that was a positive thing as well. But I do have to add that whether or not you're using exploding or a non-explosive harpoon, you can't guarantee you're going to kill a whale instantaneously, and it can be horrendously cruel and prolonged before the whale actually dies.
Well, that's an interesting point, because the footage that I've seen from that time, the killing of these whales seems so brutal. And it almost feels like some kind of strange, twisted social event. For you, who'd not been on one of these trips before, what was it like when you were faced with the reality of the scenario in front of you?
I certainly went into a mode where it was very important that I bore witness, and that was the ethos of Greenpeace and others who were documenting this kind of thing, is that you can't really be squeamish. You need to be able to observe it, and you need to be able to document it, because then you can speak about it yourself. And I think that's very, very important. And a year later, after we had been to Norway, I went to the Faroe Islands, and I went 2 years running. And that was the one thing when I saw pilot whales being killed, and that was also absolutely horrendously cruel, that it was important to have no emotion at the time, to just observe and remember and record what was going on in front of you, because then you would be able to report it afterwards. You can go through all the emotions, but at the time, you need to focus on why you're there.
See, I find that fascinating. I made a film with my director partner, Matthew Longfellow, some years ago for the band Blur for a live show, and it was The Life of a Cow Backwards. And it basically was the life of a cow backwards. You'd see a sandwich, see the sandwich being eaten, or you would see everything in reverse. So you would see the meat returning to the butcher, and then you would go to see a cow in the abattoir, and you would see all its insides being put back in, and then the end shot was the cow coming back to life in the middle of a field, and it would end the show every night. And it was amazing how many people, A, became vegetarian because of that film. But what you've just talked about is something that reminds me of filming, the day filming in the abattoir. I had no emotion going through it. I knew what we needed. We knew what we needed. We knew the shots we needed to get. It was probably horrendous. I don't know. It was only when it was finished and the next day we looked through the rushes and went through the footage that made us cry and that made us understand everything, because it was okay. Because you're right. When you're looking down the viewfinder or you're there to bear witness, you have to do everything to block off the emotions to capture that moment. But otherwise, people will never know. If it's a shaky video or it's, you know, there's terrible crying or this, that and the other and screaming, it doesn't do justice to the creatures you're trying to promote, the things that are going wrong.
Yes, that's right.
I think it's remarkable that we can have this ability to do things like that, because we need to get the information across. So, yeah, so Norway, that was a pretty successful voyage for you, wasn't it?
It was very successful, and it was actually very confusing to the Norwegians because they couldn't work out who we were, because they were kind of expecting Greenpeace to come, but there was these people. We didn't even have EIA at that time. It was just a group of people who decided to take a boat to Norway and document Norwegian whaling. I kept getting questioned all the time, "You're from Greenpeace." "No, I'm not from Greenpeace. We're journalists, we're making films about whaling and about Norway," because that was the only way we could really describe ourselves, but they couldn't get their head around it. And that was quite interesting because they assumed who we were and you just had to keep saying, "No, we're not." Fortunately, we had a really remarkable, when we were actually up in northern Norway, we had this really remarkable Dutch journalist called Yvonne Habits, who was a documentary maker and very, very well known in Netherlands. And she was fantastic about getting the story, being able to point the cameras in the right direction and ensuring that we got what we needed to get. And then she came back and made it into a very, very powerful news story, which went all around the world. And so we were lucky having her on board, and she got the issue very clearly.
And that's the thing, you need all these different components to help tell the story in different ways and in different directions, which I guess is everything we're looking to do, especially now with so many different media and formats.
Yeah.
So that set the scene for the Environmental Investigation Agency to be born, didn't it? Because next year you ended up going, as you've just mentioned, to the Faroes. How similar was that? How different was it? What did you experience on that journey? Because that was even more brutal, wasn't it?
Yes, well, it was a completely different type for a start. We didn't have any money because we hadn't set up EIA at that point. And Alan said to Dave and me, "You get on really well together. I think you should go to the Faroe Islands and see what you can find out about the pilot whale hunt." Because in those days, we knew that they had tripled the number of whales that were being killed in the previous few years compared to their 400-year average. And the economics of the islands had improved dramatically because they'd set up their economic zone and they were into the international fish business. And things were changing on the islands. And we thought, yeah, OK, but we didn't have any money, really. So we went in Dave's VW camper van and drove up to Scotland, got two ferries, ended up at the islands and thought, oh, I don't know what we're going to do now. So we had to basically set to work with working out where we should go to get information, who we should speak to. And we thought, well, we'll start with the museum. And we went there and we met a really lovely man and started learning a lot about the hunting and why the pilot whale hunt was very important to the islanders over the last 400 years and so on and so forth. And he sort of said, oh, you should talk to me so-and-so, and you should go and see so-and-so. And we suddenly learnt where the different days might be that a pilot whale hunt could take place, because it was very different in that they can take, even now, they can take place any time of the day or night and any day of the year. So you have to be on your toes to be able to catch one if you want to actually participate, but to watch it and to be able to document it. So we worked out from talking to people where there could be potentially ones, and when we just used to patrol the different bays across two islands where we might be able to see a hunt. And one day we arrived just as one had finished, but we spent the whole day down on the beach with the people who were butchering the whales and sharing out the products from the hunt and things like that. And we ended up staying the night in with a very nice chap and his wife and he participated in the hunt. He was one of the hunters. He was so kind and lovely to us, and we had a fabulous time talking to him and his wife and learning about Faroese culture and what lovely people they are. Actually, the Faroe Islands are just one of the most gorgeous places on earth, and again, a wonderful thing to be able to be there. But at the same time, there's this brutal activity that still takes place today, although far fewer whales being killed than were killed at the time when we first went there. And it was a year later we went back with a team of people where we did document a hunt of 20 where 200 whales were killed, and that was really terrible. But by the time we came back from the Faroes, we decided it would be a good idea for us to formalise the way the three of us was working. And so we set up EIA and went from there.
Okay, so that's you, Alan, and Dave Curry, isn't it?
Yes, Dave Curry, who was a wildlife photographer and had been on the Rainbow Warrior. He came on the Balanoptera with me. And then we first did the first expedition to the Faroe Islands and did a lot of investigations over the next decades of EIA.
So I just want to go back to one thing that you said, that you spent time with a hunter and had a lovely time with him. Is there a bit of a dichotomy, and how do you cope with it and how do you resolve it when you have these connections with people, but what they're doing is actually the reason that you're there protesting or documenting their activity? How do you resolve that?
I think the first thing is, it's very important if you're ever going to learn things, is to be friendly to people and to actually talk to them. Sometimes people would say, how did you get all this information? I said, well, we asked them. Just because they might be involved in killing whales doesn't mean that they're nasty people in the rest of their lives. And actually, fairies, people are tremendously interesting and very inquisitive about the rest of the world. They wanted to know more about our kind of life and what we were doing. At the same time, we were brutally honest about what we felt about the pilot whale hunt. And that's fine. You know, you have things in your compartment. So, and every time I've been there to make changes to the islands, to talk about what ending the pilot whale hunt and the issues we have with it. But at the same time, to be able to talk to them about themselves and their lives and their families, and to just enjoy these amazing, absolutely fabulous islands, which are so glorious and so interesting. And as I said, the people are there are just lovely.
Because, of course, often what the word that gets used a lot is tradition with a lot of these things.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that? And how do you get through that barrier? Well, it's tradition. It's what we do. It's what we've always done. It's a complex conversation, isn't it?
It is a complex conversation, but it has to be had. And with the Faroe Islanders, the tradition had been going for 400 years. But they hadn't really come to terms with the fact that this was something that had to be changed. It couldn't carry on the way it was. And many people hadn't thought that they wouldn't kill whales in the future. It's just one of those things you did in the islands. But they learned more and more about it as time went on, and particularly with the work that we'd been doing, the pressure we'd been putting on the government of the Faroe Islands to end the hunts.
It's interesting when you talk about talking to governments. At what point of the EIA's life were you able to go and approach people in power? It's such a strange term, but...
Well, almost straight away. And actually, going back to what I was talking about with tradition, one thing we discussed with people is tradition and culture is not something that is static, it's evolutionary. Otherwise, we'd be back living in caves. And we've evolved, and that life in the Faroe Islands and in elsewhere in the world is evolving all the time. And therefore, just because you've been doing something for 400 years doesn't mean that it's justified carrying on doing it. And that you can celebrate the contribution the pilot whales made to life in the Faroe Islands, but doesn't mean you have to continue to kill them. But I think when it comes to decision makers, to governments, you just have to not be shy. And we just used to knock on people's doors when we first went there. And the first year I met with the director of fisheries, who was a very high civil servant, and he was very frank about the islands and about the pilot whaling and things, and was very pleased to talk to us. And the year later, we had a meeting with the Prime Minister. I mean, it is a small group of islands, so it's easier to get to see the Prime Minister than it is here. But they were very happy to meet with us and to talk about it and defend what they were doing. But then we've developed our work into, with documentation, it's really, really important that you have good documentation and that you provide briefings and reports which are credible, well-written, well-produced, and that they have credibility in it, so that when you send them out to the press, you send them to governments, you ask for meetings with the government's representatives, you can speak your case and they have to listen to you, because what you're showing them is very strong evidence of something which shouldn't be going on or something that has to be changed. And so you have to be very careful that what you're writing is and what you're producing and what you're saying is correct. You don't make things up. You make sure you can back up your evidence, and that they have to listen to what you're saying and gradually work with people to make changes.
So I take it what you're saying is that your investigative skills have got to be pretty deep and they have to be pretty forensic. You are presenting a case, aren't you?
You are. It becomes more and more important as time went on. You have to check what you've done. You've got to double check when you come back. You've got film, you've got to make sure that the conditions under which you were taken were right, how you present people that you've filmed, and the evidence has to be able to be backed up. And if you're not sure about something, you can either say you're not sure about it, or you just don't include it, or you go and do more research to be able to back up what you believe is the situation, but you want to just be double sure. Because if you make mistakes, if you're sloppy, then you lose credibility and then nobody's going to listen to you.
Yeah, and I guess also you take heart from being successful with the projects that you've run. That must have been something else to have come back with all this information from the Faroes and have talked to them and maybe have helped from a very early moment elicit change within the islands. Is that how it felt to you?
We did, because they'd not really thought about stopping pilot whaling. It was just one of those things they did. And actually, what they were also doing is they were killing fin whales, and they were trying to consider whether or not they would carry on fin whaling. They were killing up to five a year, and it wasn't really a tradition, but they were doing it. The argument was, can we cope with carrying on fin whaling now that the pressure is on us from the pilot whales? And were they going to comply with the ban on commercial whaling or weren't they? And actually, the future director of fisheries came up to me at a meeting one day and he said, I think you should know that our decision to stop fin whaling was because you came to the Faroe Islands and started putting pressure on the pilot whale hunt, and we felt we couldn't cope with the pressure on the fin whaling as well as the pilot whaling. So therefore, you can see that as a bit of an achievement that you've made. And I feel rather proud of that. And I feel that there are these whales still swimming around in the Atlantic that we actually physically saved, because the Faroese government realised that they had to stop the fin whaling because we might start on that. And so that's one of my little precious moments, actually, when I think back to that.
Well, it's more than a little precious moment. I think it's a fantastic moment. I'd say that is a victory. And
yeah.
I guess really that was a marking point for you. I mean, that set out the path for the EIA to exist over, well, until the present day. And you've been involved in so many projects, from investigating the ivory trade, you know, the heightened awareness about the destruction of rainforests, overfishing of our seas, melting ice caps, CFCs. What is the latest thing that concerns you the most? Would something like plastic pollution be a huge issue for you?
There's two things, and they're both connected in many ways. One is global warming and climate change, and what impact that is having on ecosystems. But the others, which also does connect because it has an impact on global warming, is plastics. And this has become a very big issue for EIA now. It's one of our biggest campaigns, and we're working towards achieving a global agreement to reduce plastics and to tackle the problem of plastics globally. But it's huge, and something has to be done about it, because we can't continue dumping plastics into the oceans, into our land environment, wherever we go, because it's unsustainable, and eventually it will kill us as well as our whole ecosystems.
Well, because the point about plastics as well is that it doesn't disintegrate. It just turns into smaller and smaller pieces, doesn't it?
I think that's a very, very important thing to remember, because people talk about biodegradable plastics. Well, they don't exist as such. They break down. At one point, the supermarkets brought in these plastic bags, which they said were biodegradable. They were degradable, yes, but they weren't biodegradable. They just, as you say, broke down into smaller and smaller pieces of plastic until they became microplastics. And they then get consumed throughout the food chain. Those were quickly eliminated from the plastic bags. But the whole point about plastic is the only way to tackle the plastics problem is to eliminate it. We have to think about our consumption of plastics and what we can do to reduce it. This is where our campaign has focused. We've worked in Europe with groups of other organisations such as ourselves to bring about change within European law and within the UK. We worked with three other organisations in the UK to get the plastic bag charge in England. It had already been implemented in the other devolved governments, but to get that there and to get the microbead ban. What we didn't know was that people didn't realise that their face washes and some of the toothpaste and these other products had little tiny plastic particles in them, not for any benefit, but just for sort of cosmetic reasons. And we managed to persuade the UK government to implement a ban on the use of and the manufacture of products with microbeads in them. And I think that's a fantastic achievement. And it's, you know, mirrored elsewhere. But you have to change the way we're thinking about plastics. And that is massive, because it's a very important part of the oil industry's profit making. We have plastics everywhere we go. It's almost impossible to live without them. But the big thing is that you can make a difference by reducing your consumption of them yourself.
So I guess if we buy less bottles of water, that's going to make a difference. How do we impact in our own small ways? Because a lot of people say, oh, well, it's not enough what we do. But you wouldn't agree with that, would you?
No, I wouldn't. And I think every time you don't buy something in a plastic container, of whatever reason, you're making a difference. If you think of a billion people in one day saying, I'm not going to buy water in a plastic bottle today, that's a billion people saving a plastic bottle. And that is absolutely massive when it comes to plastic waste and the consumption of plastics.
How do you think of the younger people that seem to be more aware of conservation and environmental issues now? What's your thoughts on them?
It can get to a stage where you can get really depressed when you see all these, you learn of all of these terrible things. But if you look at what is happening in the world and you see these children who are making their voices heard, and they're doing sort of what we started with Greenpeace, is they're saying, we're not accepting this. You've got to stop this. You've got to make a change. It's our future, which is really, really important. And the obvious person is Greta, who has brought a sea change when it comes to the whole climate discussion and children around the world in just about every single country standing up and saying, you've got to do something about climate change. It's our future, not yours. And then you look at children. I was just so impressed when the primary school in Cornwall, the children there were horrified at the plastic red noses And so they wrote to Richard Curtis and said, you've got to stop using plastic red noses. And he turned round and he listened and he said, you're right. So one tiny little Cornish primary school must have saved so much plastic by their decision to write a letter and say, this is wrong. And this goes happening everywhere. Young people are really far, far more aware and far more prepared to take action than their parents and their grandparents. And I think there is this just greater awareness of it's their future. And it's incredibly exciting. What I get very excited about is that when we started our work, we basically had to work out how to do it because organisations like EIA didn't exist and campaigning in the way that we did it didn't exist. And so we kind of built a model for how we could bring about change. But now children go to school, they decide they want to go to university to study law or biological sciences or whatever it happens to be, so that they can come and work for organisations like mine. And there are some fantastically talented young people who are working for organisations, including mine, who are just simply awesome. And they are making a massive difference now. And that, to me, gives me hope for the future. I feel that when I feel I need to step down, there will be new generations there who are taking on the mantle of what we started. And they will take it forward. And they'll probably do it better because they've got more knowledge now. They know how to do things and they can make, there are new ways of doing things. And it is incredibly, incredibly exciting. But I really love what young children are doing. Actually, there was the little girl who wrote to Waitrose and said, you've got to stop selling children's magazines that contain plastic toys because it's a massive waste of plastic. So Waitrose thought, oh, yes, we should. So they're not selling those magazines. And I think that is just awesome.
There are so many of these amazing stories.
There are.
And the great thing is, I think that we're in a position where actually adults can learn from children. Maybe we always could. Maybe we just didn't look and listen. But I think children and the kids and the youth of today are actually some of the most inspiring people I've seen in the world so far of my life.
Yeah, I agree. They're just extraordinary.
They are. Well, look, Jenny, we're just about out of time now. Now, just to say, if anybody wants to check out your work, because there is so much to discover, and your website is fantastic, I would implore everyone to go to EIA-international.org. That's EIA-international.org. Jenny, look, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on. You've taught me so much. I hope people understand exactly what you've done through your life so far, and there's so much more that you're doing. You are a conservationist. It's been an absolute pleasure having you here. It's been much appreciated, and thank you.
And thank you for inviting me. It's been really fun and a real pleasure.
My pleasure.
Conservation Conversations is presented by me, Kerry Levy. Our series editor is Leon Rachinsky-Gorman. Our producer is Jackie Anklin. Our executive producers are Ralph Steadman and Sadie Williams. Our series consultant producer is Gary Hayes. Music by Leon Rachinsky-Gorman, lyrics by me. Find out more about conservation and conservation conversations at conservation.com and on Instagram and Twitter at conservation. Conservation Conversations is produced as part of the Highway 61 network, supporting independent producers. For more information and podcasts like this one, visit highway61.media or highway61_podcasts on Instagram and Twitter.